Hey everybody, what's going on? Rob Cesternino getting you ready for another one of our Survivor off-season interviews. And today we're going to be talking with Jessica Lewis from Millennials versus Gen X. We'll be going through everything from her game, just like we did with David and Adam and Brett here on a special one of these off-season podcasts. The Survivor off-season starting to wind down. If we start to look just over the horizon, looks like Survivor Game Changers is right around the corner. And boy, we've got a lot of content coming up for you once we hit the Survivor preseason with a special preview podcast talking about every single one of those Game Changers that's coming up. Really excited for you guys to start hearing those once the Survivor calendar changes over from the off-season to the preseason, but more on that very, very soon. A couple of things. One, many of you guys do know, especially the patrons of Rob's Podcast, know that the tickets have gone on sale for our next Survivor Know-It-Alls live show in New York City. If you are interested and in the New York City area on March 22nd, you can come out and see Stephen Fishback and I and a bunch of other people at Caroline's on Broadway. You can get tickets at robiswebsite.com/March2017KIA. That's March 2017KIA. Should be a great show. Some tickets still available if you can make it out for that night. Also, this podcast is sponsored by Books.com because this Valentine's Day is also, much like the Survivor Game Changers preseason, right around the corner. And you can be a hero this Valentine's Day and save 20% off when you order early. Now, I learned a lesson last Valentine's Day that my significant other, the lovely first lady of podcasting, Nicole Cesternino, does not like flowers from the grocery stores. It turns out the nicest thing you could do for that special someone, short of giving them the legacy advantage, are beautiful flowers sent to that special someone's door. And that's what Books.com does. Books.com has farm fresh flowers and free delivery on weekdays when you register with a simple premium experience at an accessible price. So don't wait around until the last minute. Valentine's Day is only about 2 weeks away. So check out the simple ordering with no gimmicks and no hidden fees and transparent pricing at Books.com. And again, Rob as a podcast, listeners can save 20% off their order with the promo code Rob. That's 20% off your order for farm fresh flowers at Books.com. Books.com. 20% off with promo code Rob. All right, everybody, let's get into talking with Jessica Lewis. Of course, she made Survivor history this season when she became only the third person ever to go out on a rock draw, and she had a very exciting journey all the way to the final 10. Please welcome in the great Jessica Lewis. Jessica, how are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Very good. And I also want to introduce somebody else who's here today, somebody that Jessica may be a district attorney, but she was very adamant that her number one public defender also join us on the podcast today. So please welcome back David Bloomberg. David, how are you?
Good, good.
Yes.
How's everyone else?
I think everybody's good.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I was very excited to have both of you do the podcast with me. So thank you so much.
Jessica, why did you feel like that you needed David to come in and be part of this conversation about your game? Because he's the only person that gets you?
He actually not only gets me very well, but I think he gets the game very well. Every podcast that I've listened to, and yours are fantastic, Rob, don't get me wrong. But he just views things from a different way. And I listen to him and say, yes, he's absolutely right, because it is actually what was going on in that moment or what was happening. I don't know why he just seems to understand things in that way. I think some of the game that was seen, Rob, you were not such a fan of certain components of it. So I think that, you know, having David there to say, well, what about this? It's a good thing for me, because I do think that there were components of my game that some people were very confused about and some people didn't like, and people had different takes on it and different views and different arguments. So I think it would be nice to have both of you talking about these things at the same time, because I think you saw parts of my game differently.
David, how do you feel about that? Has there ever been a survivor that has said how much you get them?
Well, you.
But you know what I will say about David is that, you know, and going back, and I can relate to it, you know, he really does go out of his way to give you like the devil's advocate of what is the player thinking? Why did these things ultimately happen? So I do think that the players tend to really relate to his analysis as opposed to a lot of other people that may just say, okay, this person did this because they're stupid. And David, once in a while, will go there. But I think that for the most part, he really does try to get in the head of what the players are doing. And I think that that's why traditionally over the years, David, I think a lot of the Survivor players, your work has really resonated with them.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Jessica. You can be my attorney anytime.
Oh, I appreciate that. Hopefully I won't have to be because that means something horrible happened to you. But
okay. So Jessica, let's get into starting to talk about your journey. And I know that we got some little hints that you had been a longtime Survivor fan. What is your relationship with the show go back to?
It actually goes back to season one. I watched the season with my then boyfriend, now husband, Aaron. We fell in love with it immediately. And ever since that first season, I have watched every season since. It's the only show that I've ever gone back to repeatedly and never miss an episode because there was just something so fascinating to me about the show. Not only the survival aspect, but the social experiment and just the different personalities. So I always loved it. And then moving through my life, it was never an option to apply because I've done so many things in such a short time span and I just couldn't fit it in. And then suddenly, a couple seasons ago, you know, I'm sitting on the couch because now I watch it with my husband and my kids. And I decided, why not? I should make a video just to see what happened. And I asked my then 12-year-old daughter to put together a video. And she did. And then that was it. That got the ball rolling. I'm one of the lucky people that applied once and got a call within a couple of months after sending in a video.
Justin, what was the reaction from your family when you told your husband and kids that you wanted to go play Survivor? Because I would have to think that it would be the kind of thing that would really throw a monkey wrench into everybody else's lives in a major way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was one of those situations where we have two kids. I have a full-time job. So does my husband. How are we going to make this all work? Plus, the job that I have is I'm a government employee, you know, so there's all of these things to consider. But I think there was this idea that I wasn't going to get a call, you know, that it was just like, oh, she's going to apply and we'll see what happens. But then when I actually did get the call, my husband about fell over. He couldn't believe it and was like, oh, great. Now this is happening. And he explained to my kids, which I thought was great. I should say our kids. When I finally was going through the process of this and getting calls back and this might happen. My husband looked at the kids and he said, you have to understand, this kind of stuff doesn't usually happen. He's like, because he thinks our children are going to have this like misconstrued view of like the future. And, yo, you want to go on a television show? It's this easy. You know, like, it's really not. But it was a lot of planning and preparation because it was going to be a huge strain on him. I was going to be gone potentially for 7 weeks. He was going to have to be the only one here with the kids. And we don't have family that's close. His family is about an hour away. Mine is about 3 hours away. So it's not like we had a close network of people we could rely on. So that was going to be a huge hurdle to overcome. But he was willing to do it. And he's actually the one that convinced me to go when I finally got the, hey, we want you on the show call. I immediately freaked out and was like, I can't do this. And I was worried because of my job. I didn't want my job to be negatively affected. And my husband said to me, Jessica, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And if you don't go, you will be forever kicking yourself for not going. He said, we will deal with and figure out the future with whatever happens. If you go and you lose your job, or if you go and you win, whatever happens, we will figure it out and we will get through it. And it was one of those moments where I really just had to say, yes, this is it. I've got to take this opportunity. And so he's been a huge support the entire time. My other family, my mother, thought I was insane, thought I was absolutely crazy. It was like, you are going to die. Something horrible is going to happen to you. Like, my mother was freaking out. She was very, very worried. My father thought it was amazing. And he knew, he's like, this is such a Jessica thing to do because she's always pushing herself and always willing to go and do all of these crazy things. So it was a weird mix from family members. Some were very supportive, other ones were not. And I just really had to kind of make the decision and decided it was worth the risk. It was worth the chance.
Jessica, you had mentioned, I think somewhere else I heard or saw, not that you're active at all on social media.
Oh, not at all.
No. that you had a murder trial coming up. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, it was. This was like the craziest experience ever, because the day that Survivor called me and said, you know, this is CBS casting for Survivor, was the same day that I was arraigning my first homicide. I had just presented it and I was standing in court. Like, this is a huge moment for me in my career where I've got my first homicide case, and suddenly Survivor is calling me and I'm like, what is happening? And I had to manage to get everything to work out time-wise, as far as I had to, you know, motions, there's a schedule for all of these things, and when's the trial going to be scheduled? And so my trial ended up being scheduled in June, and that it was literally a month after I was getting back from Survivor. So I was really like, I got a cram. this is going to be tough. But I managed to work it all out, which was incredible. But the timing of it was crazy, but I did... It worked out in the end, which is really good.
It wasn't like the guy got like the hidden immunity idol and then got away.
No, I was actually really worried, because I had no idea how any of this was going to play out with my job. Because obviously, when you're picking a jury, one of the questions that a jury panel is asked is, does anyone recognize the prosecutor? And in my mind, I thought, okay, what if someone raises their hand and says, I saw her on Survivor? And I didn't know how that was all going to affect things moving forward. But so far, everyone has been really supportive, and it really hasn't negatively affected me, thank God. Knock on wood. I won't actually knock, but I'm hoping, you know, that there are no situations down the road, because it is one of, you're putting yourself out there for the world to see. But then when you're in a courtroom, you're doing the same thing basically with that jury panel. And I didn't want there to be any negative overlap from what they saw on the television versus now what they're seeing in a courtroom.
Jess, I'm interested to know, how much do you get recognized? Now, you live in the Albany area, and when you live in like one of like a major metropolis, I feel like that, you know, people tend to not recognize you at all. But I feel like that when you go to a smaller city, I feel like that you get recognized way more, because people are really aware of it. So is that something that you are constantly recognized for?
No, it's actually really strange. I feel like the way that I looked on television is so different than the way that you see me every day, that it's kind of thrown people off. I mean, people really had to almost stop. People that I know that I work with, it took them a minute to realize that was me on the television. They were like, wait, they just said Jessica? That's Jessica? You know, so it was really, it's been strange. I think I was recognized more actually when I went to Boston. I went to go see a concert with my daughter and her and my niece, and I was getting recognized quite a bit. Oh, Troye Sivan.
Troye Sivan. That's David's favorite.
I don't even know who that is.
Troye Sivan? No.
Yeah.
Troye Sivan. Yeah, yes. That I know.
That we know. But so, yeah, that's my old stomping grounds up to New York. I have a lot of friends from that area from when I went to school in Oswego, but that's a story for another time, Jess.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So, Jess, you said you don't normally look the same as you did on Survivor. You don't normally have big, pink, puffy eyes?
No, I really don't. Oh. Yeah, that's a look special for Survivor. That was my special Survivor look.
Well, you had a very busy first couple of days, and we'll get into your eyes. But you showed up on that beach and got told that it was going to be a Gen X versus Millennials. Was that something that you ever considered going into it, that it was going to be an age-divided season?
I didn't necessarily expect that when we were going into it, but then once we were actually there before the game started and you get to kind of size everybody up, age was one of the things that I had determined might be a factor in dividing people, because there did seem to be such a huge distinction. Like, I went through and I was trying to guess everybody's ages, and when I did that, I kind of had a good breakdown and thought, this could be two tribes with, you know, age being the division. And it turned out that it was. So, you know, that I thought was a good read just from sitting there, but I didn't expect that that's what it necessarily was going to be. I'm not David, who guessed it was going to be Millennials. but yeah, I thought that it could be.
So when you saw everyone there, what did you guess Will's age was?
Oh, I thought he was by far the youngest. I think I guessed him at 19. And I even because we kind of take notes about everybody. And one of the things I wrote down about him was just how young he looked. He looked incredibly young. And I guessed 19 was the age that I guessed for him.
Jess, what was it like to sort of like realize that the tribes were potentially divided by age or eventually divided by age, and having to come to terms with that you're on the older tribe, because we're about the same age? And I feel like I don't think of myself as, you know, oh, I would be in the older group, but right. It's something that you had to, you know, come to terms with. What were you thinking during that point?
Well, I don't feel like I'm 37 years old. I'm not really sure how 37 is supposed to feel, but I feel relatively young for my age. And I feel like I look relatively young for my age. So I found out later that the younger people had guessed I was going to be on their tribe. So I thought that's a nice yes. thing to hear. You know, that you're like, okay, good. They thought I was one of them. But overall, I didn't mind that division existed, because I do feel like there is such a distinct difference between my generation and the generation coming up, and just the difference of how the younger generation views life and almost feels like there's this sense of they deserve it. That's something that I've kind of seen, that there's like this sense of, I can't think of the right word right now, but like they should have it because they want it, as opposed to they should earn it. And that was something that I've seen just growing up even. And so for me, that really kind of resonated with me when I heard that it would be millennials versus Gen X, because I do think I'm someone who has worked very hard for everything I've gotten, and nothing was handed to me. And the newer generation has more of an expectation that you don't necessarily have to work as hard, but you'll still get there if you try, if that makes sense.
Just now, in the first couple of minutes of the game, you guys have to go out and gather a bunch of different supplies, and you have some choices as to what to get. But as you're doing that, you stumble across something which would go on to be the legacy advantage. Can you just talk through your thought process upon finding it, what you thought it was, and what your reaction to what it ultimately was?
I was really excited when I found it, obviously, but I was also very nervous, because I didn't want anyone to see me with it. And I think the nervousness really hit when we got all done collecting everything, because Jeff said, if it's not on the mat, you can't keep it. And so I thought, oh God, you know, like this, I had it in the back of my shirt and I didn't want it to be an issue, but I've seen enough issues, you know, enough shows of Survivor, enough seasons of Survivor to know that something that's in an envelope like that doesn't need to be on the mat. So, you know, I couldn't wait to read it. I was very anxious to do so. And also at that point, you don't understand production. You don't understand mm-hmm. how all of this is going to work. And I clearly had a microphone on, you know. And so I was really worried when they then had to de-mic us. And I thought, oh, my God, I've got this in the back of my shirt. And they're like literally taking our mics off. Like, and I thought, what if someone, you know, what if they blow up my game right now? You know, like that's what I was thinking. But obviously, CBS has done this for a long time, and they don't do that to people. So it was fine. But yeah, my guess when I found it was that it would be a clue to a hidden immunity idol. That's what I thought. I thought that that's what it would be. And it wasn't, obviously. So I was a little shocked when I saw what it was, because day 36, when you're there on day one, sounds like it's so far away. But you're still in your mind thinking, I can do this because I'm going to win. I'm going to be there. So that's okay. But it was almost like a crushing moment, because you see day 36 and realize how far away that really is in this game and how many things can happen before you get to day 36. So I was hoping it would be something I could use sooner rather than later. But then at the same time, I thought day 36 is a great day to have an advantage in the game as well. So there was that kind of, you know, I was a little bit torn, because I wanted something more immediate, but then at the same time, the gratification from having something on day 36 could have been fantastic, and it would have been, but unfortunately I didn't get to see that.
Were you starting to think about ways to leverage it? It seems like in the first episode, there's a point where David comes up to you and you're asking him if he has an idol, and it seems like you're leading into maybe some sort of like trade of information or some sort of a deal to potentially work out with him. But then other than just telling Ken about it, you don't do anything else with the legacy advantage. Was that something that you were thinking about in terms of using it in an unconventional way?
I had thought about it, but I decided it would be better if I was going to use it later down the road, like maybe when we got down to closer to, you know, 5 or 6, if there was an issue and I needed to really solidify myself somewhere or make a deal with someone, when we get down to 5 or 6, it would be better. But at the same time, the conversation I had with David, I wasn't planning on sharing that information with him at all because I didn't have a good relationship with him yet. I actually told him in that conversation, if he had an idol, to give it to me and I would just hold it, that I wouldn't play it, I wouldn't use it, that I would actually just keep it. And then afterwards, when he voted with us, I would give it back to him. That was what I explained to him.
Wow. Yeah. This is like when you get booked and they take your stuff, right?
Yeah. So I was like, because in my mind, I thought that way I know he has it. And he will have to vote with us because if he wants it back, that's the only way he's going to get it back. I thought, why not just try it and see what happened? But he was adamant he didn't have one. And at that point in time, he didn't have it yet. So when he said to me, you know, I wish I do, you know, I wish I did have one because I would give it to you. But unfortunately, you know, at that point, he hadn't found it yet. But I did consider some options. And I think now that I'm like out of the game, I've had the ability to think a little bit more, you know, what could I have done with it? Because even sitting in that final tribal I was sitting in before he went to rocks, I knew I had it in my bag and I was thinking about, could I do something with the legacy? But in that moment, it could be a huge detriment for you to kind of put that on display to everybody and be like, hey, by the way, I've got this legacy. Anyone want to work something out with me? You know, I mean, you're in the middle of tribal council. So, you know, I kind of toyed with it at that point too. If I had been able to like pull Will off to the side, maybe that would have worked out. But, you know, sitting there in front of everybody, that could have been a dangerous move.
The legacy advantage itself, from what we saw, the only way you could pass it is by leaving the game. There wasn't any way you could work it out by trading it like an idol or anything like that.
Well, it was weird because I think you could, and I think that's what the hope was, because the actual envelope itself had all of these lines written on it for where you could write various people's names on it. So I think the hope was that it would be utilized in some fashion where you could wheel and deal with it. But in my mind, I thought, I don't want to wheel and deal with something that's potentially going to get me further in the game on day 36 if I don't have to. So I was waiting for a moment where I might have to do that, but it wasn't something that presented itself necessarily. I had considered maybe something with Chris because at, you know, a certain point in time, Chris was not very happy with me. And I didn't know if maybe that's something I could utilize then, but I wanted to hang on to it as long as I could. But when you have something that you don't even know what it is, it can almost be more dangerous to wheel and deal at that point, because here's an advantage for day 36. So the person that you're giving it to has to be there on day 36 to use it. And then if that person gets voted out, then that person gets to give it to somebody else. And so what if that person then gives it to an individual who's not someone who's in my alliance or someone I'm working with, and they suddenly have an advantage on day 36 that could then negatively affect me? So I really had to kind of think through that if I were to say, hey, I want to give this to you, is that a person that is then going to potentially give it to somebody else that I would want to continue to play the game with, or be okay if they had an advantage on day 36? There's, I mean, so many computations that you kind of go through in your head because you don't know where it's eventually going to end up, you know, and that was what I had to think about as well. If I'm going to give this to somebody else, whose hands could it eventually end up in?
What was your hypothesis for what the advantage could be?
I thought it was going to be, you get to go out and practice whatever immunity challenge was that day before anyone else, that you'd get extra time, whether it be a maze or, you know, some type of a machine that you have to run through and learn how it works. That's what I thought it was. I never thought for a second it was immunity. I never for one second did that cross my mind. I thought for sure it was going to be that type of advantage, or potentially a nullification of someone's vote, or you get to vote twice. Those were the things that I thought it was going to be. But immunity was not one that ever crossed my mind.
Did you find it to be less powerful than you thought it was going to be?
Yes. And I think it was less powerful because utilizing it was it was hard because here's something that I have that I don't even know what it is. And first of all, you don't want to tell anybody I've got a legacy. I've got this advantage on day 36, because if you tell the wrong person, and I did choose to tell Ken because I wanted to get Ken back in my good graces. But if you tell the wrong person, then that's information that people have against you and might say, well, listen, she's got this legacy. We don't know what it is, but if she gets voted out, she's got to pass it off to someone. So if we get rid of her, she has to give it to someone else. And if I know she has it, and if I'm her friend, maybe she'll give it to me if I get her voted out. You know, so there's this idea that someone could use it against you who could potentially be acting as your ally. And then there's also the unknown factor where even if I were to say to somebody, I have this advantage, you can't use it till day 36, I will give it to you if you flip your vote or if you come with us. They might say, sure, or they might say, sure, and then use the information against me. I mean, there's all of these ways that it could be negatively viewed because it is one more piece of information that someone can use against you. And the only control that I really had over it was if I left the game, I could choose who got it. If I decided to pass it off to someone, then that person could pass it off as well. And where then I lose the control over it. And so in my mind, I didn't really want to be passing it around for the mere fact that then I don't know where it ends up and I don't know who has it.
Boston Rob has said the same sort of thing about the hidden immunity idol of like the best use of the hidden immunity idol is just to keep it on yourself because then you always know where it is. And
exactly.
So you can control ultimately how it's played. Interesting thought with the legacy advantage. My thought was that the whole reason it existed was for people to find out about it. So people would come after the holder of the legacy advantage, which didn't exactly happen. Was that really your fear that people would target a person that had some sort of a power that people were afraid of?
Yes, because with the idols is a good example of that. When people find out that someone might have an idol, then suddenly that person becomes a target and is someone that people are talking about. And they want to talk about flushing the idol and they want to talk about trying to take it out of the game. The difference with the legacy is it doesn't get taken out of the game. It comes right back when you get voted out and you don't know who that, like, no one knew that I had it except Ken. So no one knew that Ken had it because I had given it to him. So there is at least that secretive component of it. But at the same time, it's one of those situations where it doesn't necessarily benefit you to be telling everybody that you have this thing that you can use on day 36 and nobody knows what it is, because all it does is give people information about you that can be negatively used against you in your game.
So in some ways, do you think it was almost a trap, kind of like the quote unquote advantage that Adam got for stealing a reward?
I think it could definitely be seen that way. I mean, I would not have wanted Adam's advantage at all, because that's one absolutely people will despise you for, as Adam said, ruining someone's day greatly. And, you know, I feel like this is one of those situations as well, because it's an unknown. And any time in Survivor when there is an unknown, that is truly when I think people become scared and they become worried and more nervous because they don't know what this is. It's this envelope that on day 36 allows her to do something. And we don't know what that something is. And then they could take it a step further and say, well, if we vote her out, who is she going to give it to? Is she going to give it to David? Is she going to give it to Ken? Is she going to give it to the people that she's closest to? So then you're almost targeting those individuals as well. If they take me out because they're worried about this day 36 advantage, well, then they have to worry about who I gave it to. And then does that put a target on someone else's back? So it's this whole weird cyclical thing because you're not sure what the actual advantage is. So in my mind, the best way to play it was I'm keeping it and I'm going to use it on day 36 when I'm still here, because then I will be the one that has the ultimate advantage because I'm the only one that knows about it other than Ken. And if I can't use it, Ken will be using it. And so in my mind, that was the better way to control the information. So it certainly wasn't as fun as I think the Survivor gods were hoping it would be. But for me, I've seen enough seasons of the show to know that knowledge is power. And as soon as someone knows something about you, that can be used against you. And I wanted to be very careful with who I shared it with. And although I did share it with Ken, I had to share it with Ken because I needed someone else to play the game with me besides David. And the only way that I was going to gain favor with Ken again was if I shared something with him, because I knew how he was about trust and loyalty. So I thought, if I share this information with him, he will believe me, he'll come back, and he'll want to play the game with me. And that worked, so which was great.
You know, you bring up Ken, and I know this is a little bit further down the line, but I feel like that a lot of the other cast members from your season, both the ones that I've talked to and, you know, in reading other interviews that people have done, it seems like that not everybody shared your enthusiasm about Ken. What was it that you saw in him that other people didn't really connect with?
I love how you explain that didn't share my enthusiasm. That was good.
No, I mean, that he's somebody who is going to get to 39 days into the game, but be a zero vote finalist. And I think that he's a player that I've definitely heard, if not outright animosity, people have really not been feeling great about Ken and their time with him.
And I totally understand your assessment and why you would qualify it like that.
And again, not my feelings that apparently he's a great guy, right?
and he is. And this is the thing with Ken, and this is what I've tried to say previously to explain him. He is someone who plays this game at a different pace. He plays the game at a slower pace. And because I think he was playing it at a slower pace, that was an advantage for me because I didn't have to worry about him kind of spinning the game and trying to make moves and make things happen, because that's not the way his mind was working. His mind was very focused on food and shelter and survival. And then on the back end, it was, oh yeah, and then we're playing this game, you know, where we have to strategize. And so he was a perfect person to align myself with, because I realized after that whole debacle where he came to me and said, Lucy is gunning for you, and I didn't believe him, how crushed he was that I didn't believe him, I learned very quickly that he really is someone who takes that to heart. And when he tells you something, he's going to mean it. And it's going to mean a lot to him when he is sharing information with you. And so I thought he would be a great person to utilize moving forward, because not only will he provide food and the survival component of the game will be, you know, a benefit to me, he's also someone who I don't have to worry about going behind my back and turning on me, because loyalty to him was so important. And I learned that very early on. And so in my mind, keeping Ken close to me was a great component of my game because of that loyalty that he wanted to have with whoever was playing the game with him. So it really was a huge benefit. But I also think that I think one of the things that David, you had said about Ken was that with one of the criteria about keeping politics and beliefs to yourself, one thing that Ken, I think, wasn't very good at was keeping his politics and beliefs to himself. And I don't think that was shown very much on the actual show itself. But Ken was very willing to speak his mind about how he felt about various things. And one of the things that he had referenced during the game when he was speaking to myself and Taylor was that lobbyists and lawyers kill them all. And he had no idea I was a lawyer. And so I heard this and was blown away, because here I am, his closest ally, and he's talking about, you know, his hate of lawyers. And so I thought it was rather comical. And never said anything to him about it until the final tribal.
You're
where
like
I did
Donnie
actually.
Brasco.
Yeah, so I decided not to mention it to him until, like, I actually did in the final tribal say something to him about it. But he was that kind of person where he was very honest about his feelings and how he would be affected by things. And so I think that that was part of the reason why he rubbed some people the wrong way. Because he was very clear about how he felt and very vocal about how he felt about things in the world. But as far as the game was concerned, his strategizing wasn't like other people in the game.
Speaking of that, did you get the feeling, or did he talk about how much Survivor had he seen up to that point?
I was always mixed about that. I know that he watched a lot of Survivor, but then he also talked a lot about how he was off the grid for a really long time.
He should be on Hunted.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I watched Hunted, by the way, with my husband.
Yes.
The first episode. And I know this is totally off topic, but really, you use the ATM and you take the bus from the same station where the ATM is located. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Anyway, spoiler alert for people that don't watch
the first episode. So, that was a disaster.
That was such a disaster. But anyway, I think Ken, old school Survivor, would probably have been better for Ken because he was very interested in the survival aspect, and everyone was kind of figuring out the whole alliance thing at the beginning and the strategizing component. And he had said, I think, in one of his interviews that he guessed he just wasn't as cutthroat as you need to be to play this game. And I don't think it's being cutthroat. I don't think people were necessarily being cutthroat. I think people were being strategic and people were looking at their game and how they can further their game. Whereas Ken just kind of viewed it as almost an ever evolving thing. And I'm going to continue to provide for people, and I'm going to continue to have relationships with people, and then that will carry me through, which worked, but it carried him through in a position he didn't necessarily want to be in. And that was a position where most of the people thought they could beat him in a final three, but he didn't see it that way. And so that was also a good benefit to have as far as my game was moving forward, because he thought that if he and David and myself were sitting in the final three, that it would be extremely close and it would probably be only one vote that would separate the, you know, whoever was the winner. So again, great person to say, let's go to the final three then, because if he feels like he can beat me, okay. You know, that's a good place for me to be in. And I think that's part of where he ended up going wrong and how he was looking at the game.
Let's get into talking about the internal politics of this Gen X tribe, because this is going to be super important to your game and how it ultimately shakes out. So you guys, there's the Typhoon, right? You guys mm-hmm. come back and now you go to the first tribal council, and it is a big decision that needs to be made. So could you talk a little bit about how you saw the power dynamics in that group and how you guys land on Rachel being the person to go home?
Yeah, I think it was really obvious very quickly within our group who was working together. I and Sunday connected very quickly, and Cece and Rachel connected very quickly. David, no one was really sure about, but he and Ken seemed to be chatting a lot. Ken seemed to connect with Rachel, but again, not too sure where he was at. But like Brett and Chris, they were together almost right from the start. So there was little groups forming very quickly, and Paul glommed on to Chris and Brett very quickly as well. And once that all happened, it, I think, kind of set in motion how the relationships were going to form, because I ended up having a conversation with Paul. I think that was like on like day one. And Paul said to me, listen, I've got Brett and Chris. They're with me. Do you have Sunday? And I said, I think so. You know, she's close with me. And he's like, all right, good. Because I want us to work together. We've also got Lucy. So we'll have six. But Brett and Chris didn't want you in the six, but I wanted you in the six. So they wanted Rachel or Cece, but we're going to go with you because you come with Sunday. There was that kind of conversation. And I thought, okay, you know, with, mm-hmm. yeah. where clearly there's some issue then with Brett and Chris, who were not interested in working with me. And my take on that was looking at who the options were as far as moving forward with a six. What type of female did Chris and Brett want to be working with? And I felt like I didn't present myself as someone who would necessarily be a follower. And I think for Chris, that was probably not the type of individual he wanted in the six, whereas Rachel or Cece might be deemed that way. And so it was one of those situations where I saw very quickly that Brett and Chris and Paul were going to be a very tight three. And that really kind of, I set that in my mind. And so I thought I would be good to then have a very tight three as well. And so I was trying to keep Sunday and Lucy working as a tight three as well. Lucy was tough though, because she didn't really interact that much. She was very headstrong in a lot of her opinions about how we should do things on the island, but she wasn't someone that I felt like I could relate to very well, other than we both had kids and we could talk about being mothers and things like that. But it seemed a little strained. So the dynamics were odd, and I did try to venture out and say, well, let's see what my other options are. And when I went to Ken's view on the game was, I don't really want to talk about strategy right now. I just want to focus on building a shelter and getting food, and that's what I want to focus on. So, okay, that makes it a little bit difficult. And so it was almost like the six came together extremely quickly. And was that necessarily my ideal six? No, but it still was a great six because I was part of the six. And I thought, okay, well, at least I'm part of the six and I can figure out dynamics as we move forward. But I saw very quickly that Ken and Paul did not mesh very well. They didn't get along very well. And Rachel was someone who was, I think, rubbing people the wrong way quickly just because she was very vocal and she was kind of in your face. Like, she came up to me at one point and was like, have you seen David? Do you know where David is? Do you know what he's up to? And I was like, well, it wasn't my turn to watch David. So I don't know. I'm not sure where he is. But she was a little frantic, I think, at the beginning. I mean, people talked about David being paranoid, but she seemed to be paranoid as well. And she also seemed to be heading off a lot on her own and kind of disappearing, which also made people nervous because she was accusing David of looking for an idol. People thought she might be doing the same. And then she seemed to be connecting with Ken, and nobody really knew where Ken was at because he didn't want to talk strategy with anyone. So it was one of those situations where we knew that CeCe and Rachel were close and we weren't sure about Ken, but we just decided, as far as personalities is concerned, Rachel was someone who really was kind of frantic and a little all over the place and someone who we were, I think, concerned with moving forward as far as decision making and how we were going to handle the game. She made some decisions right off the bat with the first challenge where she wanted to swing, you know, and break the head of, you know, the wooden emblem in order to drop the flag, which seemed odd considering we had, you know, Chris, who should be probably doing that, but she really wanted to. Mm-hmm. And then she was adamant about doing the puzzle, which clearly was not a success. And so it was one of those situations where she was just so vocal in her opinions and her thoughts that I think she just, she made people nervous because you just weren't sure where Rachel was coming from.
Okay, so you guys vote out Rachel, and now we are in the full-fledged Paul era of the Gen X tribe. So we're going to talk about Paul and ultimately how he goes home, but can you just talk about Paul's reign as the leader of the Gen X tribe, and is that just sort of like a TV concoction?
No, it's actually not a TV concoction. And I have to say, I really do like Paul. And I liked Paul a lot before the game started. I liked Paul during the game. But the situation that I saw with Paul was he was someone who was very clear about where his loyalties were. And his loyalties were with Brett and Chris. And as much as he is now, I think, stressing that he wanted to have a close relationship with me, building that relationship was hard because, for one, he's telling me Brett and Chris don't want to work with you. And then he tells me, and I know they only showed the conversation once, but it was multiple conversations where, and this was not a misinterpretation on my part, where he said, if the guys come to me and they want to go all guys, I'm going to pat you on the back and say, good luck, kid. Mm-hmm. He was going to be going with the guys, and he was trying to get Ken in on the guy thing. There was a lot of work, I think, being made as far as making relationships with men. And when even when they went on the recon mission,
the summit.
There was some, yes, the summit, there was some definite concerns that I had when they came back, because they had immediately split off to go and talk with the guys and made it sound like production told them to do it. And it was this, there was a lot of just questionable things happening. And he was very close with Brett and Chris. And I saw them as a very dangerous three moving forward, because they seemed adamant in playing the game together, which if you're thinking long term, three people strong, that can be dangerous if they don't have your best interests at heart. And I didn't think that Chris had my best interests at heart, clearly, because he didn't necessarily want to be in a six with me. So there was a lot of things that was kind of swimming through my head. And then there was things like, for example, we would sit at night and we would watch the sunset. And there was this really incredible tree that was right in front of where we would watch the sunset, but there was no foliage on it, but it was a really neat tree. And everyone would sit and look out into the water and watch the sunset. But Paul would sit on the tree above us, like looking down at us. And, you know, that was one of those things where it was almost like it was like his throne and we were his minions. And not that he necessarily represented it that way, but it just came across that way. And so I think that people really were growing tired of feeling like they were less than Paul. But again, it's not because he is a bad guy. He's a great guy, but he just has a very outgoing personality. And he liked the attention. I think he liked kind of being in control and being in charge. So that was something that everyone was recognizing and dealing with. And then when we had the conversation about the possibility of an all guys thing happening, the reaction from Lucy and Sunday was immediate. And I never mm-hmm. even suggested that we vote him out. I just said, I want you to know what Paul told me. And Lucy was the one who said immediately, if you want to vote him out next, I'm good with that. We can vote for Paul. And Sunday immediately jumped on board as well. And Sunday was, and I've said this before, she was like giddy about voting Paul out. And she and I had talked about it. And I was like, should we really do this? Is this the best thing? And she said, yes, you know, we should do this sooner rather than later. She's like, I want to do it tomorrow. You know, she was like really excited about doing this. And so it was one of those things that I think once the ball started rolling on that, there were so many people that were willing to jump on board that I thought it would better the tribe, because clearly everybody had some personal issue with Paul in some fashion, because it didn't seem to necessarily be a vote that was based on performance. It seemed to be a vote that was based on interactions and his relationships and how he was representing himself to people.
Well, let's get into this Paul conversation that you had, because I do feel like in talking with other people that have come through here, from Paul in his exit interview and most recently talking to Brett a week or two ago, they still maintain that it was not an all guys thing that was going to happen. Do you feel like that this is some revisionist history on their part, or do you feel like that maybe things weren't quite clear as to what they were going to do?
I think it's a combination of both. I do think that Paul had a tendency to say things before he necessarily thought them through. But my concern was he said it multiple times. And it was one of those situations where I looked at it and it made me worry. It definitely made me worry, because I felt like he was keeping his options open, which is fine if you want to keep your options open. But the manner in which he was presenting it, I knew that it wasn't going to be good for my game moving forward. And I think that Brett was very interested in working with Chris. And I think Brett would have done whatever Chris said. And I know that Chris said, Paul is the kind of guy that you take to the end of this game, because of his personality. And so it was one of those circumstances where those three, no matter what, were going to be very tight. And I was very worried about how they were going to then utilize that three moving forward. And so I think that there's a combination of both things going on. That did they sit down and have conversations and say, yes, we're going to do an all guys thing? I don't think they necessarily sat down and did that. But I think at the same time, they were very aware that they wanted to work together, and they were trying very hard to bring other guys into the group. You know, they were trying to bring Ken in. There had been conversations with David. They were going to the summit and talking to the guys about, you know, working with the guys. And so maybe subconsciously they really were thinking about doing that. But at the same time, it wasn't a set plan, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. One thing I was thinking, you know, several people, including Brett and others, have said, well, he only said it the once, or it was a slip of the tongue. Whereas you had said, I think in your previous interview with Rob, that he had said it multiple times. And I'm thinking, well, if he had said it multiple times, they're only going to show it once on TV, and these other people weren't there, so they wouldn't have known.
Exactly. And that was the other part of it too, that was the first time he said it to me, we were like on a path and we were walking down the path, and I'm not sure why it even came up. I think we were talking about how we were going to be voting for the first vote. And I think that was when we were discussing voting for Rachel and splitting the votes and adding Cece, because we weren't sure if Rachel had an idol. And I think that might've been the first time that he mentioned it to me. And it was, it almost felt like a punch to the gut when he said it to me, because it's great to have someone who wants to be so open and honest with you when you're playing Survivor, because then you kind of know where his head is at. But then I'm like, now I know where his head is at. And so if we are in a six, and if we get to a situation where he has to choose, I don't think he's choosing me. I think he's choosing Brett and Chris. And so in my mind, that was going to potentially be an issue. And then he mentioned it again when we were at the tree at the time that you saw. And then when we had the summit, there was discussions when they came back. We had a whole plan when they were going on that mission. Not that they do not split up, don't leave Cece and David alone, because we don't want them talking to millennials by themselves, because we weren't sure what they were going to do. And they came back and were very vocal about the fact that they were made to split up and they were made to go off and talk with the guys. And, you know, and that they ended up having these conversations with the young kids. And Paul was very proud of the fact that the young kids looked up to him like a father figure, and that they were asking him all of these questions about how to survive, and that people were really relying on him. And I think that Paul is someone whose ego could have been easily stroked. And that's why I think Chris was so close to Paul, because you could stroke Paul's ego and make him feel very important and significant, which then is going to You can utilize him in the game by doing that. And so there was all of these factors with Paul that I feel like made him more of a danger than he realized, because he's so outgoing, because he has this personality, and because he's someone who likes to be in charge, and he's someone who other people will look to and realize that guy likes to be in charge, so I'm going to glom on to that. That can then be a dangerous thing moving forward for people in the game that aren't working with him to do that. And so it was this whole strange combination that I don't know if ultimately it was the best choice. I think at the time it seemed like the best choice, because the reaction that the whole tribe had is as far as, you know, voting Paul out. And that's, I think, part of what the whole situation frustrates me the most, is that after it occurred, I was the only one that anyone had any negative response to voting in the fashion that I did. And I know Brett said in one of his actual, one of his interviews, it might have been with you, Rob, where he said it's really hard to trust someone who's voted against you. But Sunday voted against him too. And he was talking about me when he said that, and it was in reference to the Paul vote. But Sunday voted against him as well. And he had no trouble moving forward with Sunday and playing the game with Sunday. And so I feel like I ended up kind of becoming the, you know, the scapegoat for everybody, because I was the only one that was willing to step up and say, listen, this is why we did what we did. And no one else wanted to do that. So, you know, that's the part of it that frustrates me a lot, is that there were reasons for that decision. Everyone was on board with the decision at the time it was being made. But then afterwards, they saw a very upset Chris and a very upset Brett. and panicked. Whereas I thought if we have an upset Chris and an upset Brett, that can be good for us. Because if Chris and Brett don't feel like they have anywhere else to go, what are they going to do? They have to come with us. There's only two of them. And there's, you know, how many more of us? You know what I, so that was kind of what I was thinking, was that if Lucy and Sunday and I had stayed strong, and then we had Ken and David, well, we're five, and they're two. So if they want to move forward and still, you know, have a shot at playing in the game with the majority of people who are on the tribe, well, then what other choice do they have? But that obviously wasn't where everyone else's head was at. So it didn't work.
How much outreach did you do to Brett and Chris following the Paul vote? Was it just the type of situation where it's like, okay, we have the numbers now and they can come back and talk to us if they want to? Or did you try to do damage control following that vote?
Oh, I tried to do damage control immediately, right when we got back after the vote. And I said to both of them, I said, if you want to talk about this, let's talk about it. And Chris wanted nothing to do with talking about it and was very angry. And then Brett and I started talking about it. And then Chris immediately got even more mad because we weren't talking to him. But I was like, you just said you didn't want to talk about it. So they were, there was quite a few heated words exchanged following tribal council that night between Brett and Chris. Against me. They were very, very angry with me. They weren't angry with anyone else. It was mostly just at me. But then afterwards, I did sit down. I think it was just the next morning. I sat down with Brett and he and I had a really great conversation. We talked to him about it. Sunday was involved in that conversation. And he was like, you know, I just needed a time. I just needed to settle down. And I get it. He's like, I think I was just upset because I was left out of the loop. He's like, if you guys had come to me and said this is what you want to do, I would have, you know, voted with you too. So, you know, I did talk to Brett and then I talked to Chris and I also was relying very heavily on Sunday to help bring them back into the fold because she told me, she's like, I will work on Chris and Brett. Don't worry about those guys because I knew they were going to be upset with it. And Sunday had assured me that she would work that angle. So I trusted Sunday to do that. Unfortunately, that was probably a wrong choice as well, because it turns out that she didn't try to fix it as far as their view of me as it related to that whole vote.
Now, the whole situation is going to turn where now Sunday and Lucy want to get together with Chris and Brett. Are you sensing that the tide has shifted at all after Paul's departure?
I wasn't. And that's the part of it that why I think what we saw on television wasn't a great representation necessarily as to the lead up to that, because at that point in time, we had talked, things seemed better. We won a challenge. We had some great food. You know, it felt like we were in a better place and it felt like we were going to be okay. Chris still seemed angry, but I thought we'll be all right because we'll be able to turn the tide and we're going to be fine. And I wasn't getting a bad read on the situation from Sunday or from Lucy, who I was relying on as we moved forward. And, you know, Ken seemed great and David seemed great. So I was like, okay, I think we're in a good place. And that whole moment where suddenly my name was being talked about, it happened very close in time to before we went to tribal council. Like there wasn't like a huge lead up to it where I had a couple of days to kind of process it. It was what felt like, you know, moments before we were going to tribal council. And I ended up initially when Ken came at me with the information, he came at me in a manner that I wasn't accustomed to with Ken. It was very aggressive and it was very kind of in my face. And then you saw on television the follow-up conversation that he and I had about it. But on the outset, I thought, wow, this is a little bit much that he's coming at me like this. And so in my head, I'm thinking, okay, I need to go back to my people because Sunday and Lucy are supposed to be close with me. So that's why I thought I should check with these people. They're in my alliance. Ken is a new person as far as my game is concerned and his willingness to work with me. So I'm going to go talk to my people. And I went right to Sunday, and she and I talked, and she assured me, you don't need to worry about anything. Nobody's writing your name down. Everything is fine. We're voting for Stacey like we all talked about. That's what's happening. And I even checked with Chris, and I checked with Brett. Like, I went back to all of them and tried to just see where everyone's head was at. And everyone's head was where I thought it needed to be. And I know it appeared as if I was, you know, running around, like, you know, and kind of, you know, telling on Ken. But in my head, Ken was a new component to this group. And I thought that Lucy and Sunday had my back. And unfortunately, they didn't. And I should have read Lucy better. But like I said, Lucy was someone who was hard to always interpret as far as, you know, I mean, she seemed pretty, I don't know, she was pretty set in her ways and her thoughts and what she wanted to do. But I never got the impression from her that she was somehow going to take it out on me about, you know, let's blame Jessica for the poll vote. I didn't get that sense at all from her. If anything, I thought that, you know, we were good. The three of us were okay. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. And so I definitely kick myself now because I completely misread everyone's reaction to that situation. But in my mind, it didn't make sense, I guess, because we were all like, that was a group decision as far as I was concerned, you know, as far as voting out Paul. It was a group decision that we all made. And then to suddenly have people like Sunday, who I was very close with, targeting me, didn't make sense, especially when she was the person that I went back to. I must have gone back to her 6 times before we walked out to tribal council, just to make sure that everything was good, everything was good. And she kept assuring me, we're fine, you're good, you don't need to worry about it. She was very motherly about the whole thing. She was very, it seemed meaningful when it came from her. Even at tribal council, she was winking at me. She was making C's on her fingers. She was assuring me, you're fine, you're good. And I put my faith in Sunday. That's what I ultimately ended up doing, was putting my faith in Sunday. And I that was a hard lesson learned, because I thought that she had my back, and it turns out she didn't. And she was the person from like day one that I had formed a relationship with. And lesson learned that doesn't necessarily mean things as, you know, the game moves forward. But it was a lot to process.
Now, jumping ahead, you know, both to Ponderosa and outside the game, have you gotten an explanation from Sunday and or Lucy as to, you know, what happened there? Why did they blame you? Was it for game reasons? Did they have a different view of the way things went down? What have you heard from them?
It's very strange. I haven't really talked to Lucy about it much. I don't really think we've talked about it at all. But Sunday and I did have a chance, obviously, to reconnect to Ponderosa. And even during the game, you know, I talked to her a little bit about it, too. And it was always very odd. And her response was almost one that it frustrated me further. Like, for example, when we came together at the merge and I said, Sunday, I'm like, did you get a chance to talk to Brett and kind of smooth things over for me? And she said, no. And that was kind of it. And I always kind of felt like she was just leaving me out to dry almost, where it, you know, where it, maybe she saw it as, well, this is a great strategic move for her because suddenly there's going to be someone that will be a target for these individuals and she can and utilize them. But I think from what I've learned from Sunday and what I've learned from Chris afterwards was that Sunday talked to Chris and Chris said, I made her cry. So he was very, he felt like he was able to, I think, make Sunday feel really bad for what she had done. And I think that he played on Sunday's emotions. And this is just my take on it. But once he said, and this was later, this is in Ponderosa, he was explaining this to me, but once he had her crying, he knew that he had her back. And I think that, you know, in Sunday's mind, she wanted to have a relationship with Brett and Chris because she liked them, I think, as people. And I liked them too, but as far as the game was concerned, I think she might have made the wrong choice, because I think by going along with Brett and Chris, she put herself in more of a, like, not a leadership role and one that was necessarily calling the shots. It was more of a following role, and she was doing what Chris and Brett wanted her to do instead of really doing what she should be doing for her own game. Because Sunday, sitting next to Brett and Chris in the final three, she's not winning. And that was something that I kind of always thought when I would see that three together, that she might want to rethink her position and where she's at in the game. So I think that the explanation that I've gotten from Sunday is one that she wanted to have a friendship with them. And for whatever reason, in order to do that, she had to kind of toss me aside.
But in defense of Sunday, let me just play it out the other way, where if her and Lucy go to Brett and Chris and then get you voted out after the Paul vote, if David doesn't play that idol, isn't that the beginning of something that she can say was a move that she made in the game to take out somebody who was a threat?
Oh, I think she certainly could have done that. And it all depends on what kind of spin you want to put on it. But I think at the time, if she had done that, it didn't then become represented in that fashion. You know, it took her a really long time to even say, I think Jessica's going to target me. I should start thinking about targeting Jessica. The whole thing to me felt like Lucy and Sunday's response was a reactionary response to two people being very upset, instead of them realizing strategically where we are now in the game. You know, where we were worried about what Brett and Chris and Paul were going to do moving forward, as far as who else were they going to be bringing in on this group and who was going to be in charge. Well, now it could have been Sunday and Lucy and Jessica in charge and kind of determining who's coming in on the group. So I think that their response was more reactionary to what they had, because they had seen people upset. And those people played on their emotions and realized, well, if these people are upset, maybe we can utilize that. I think that it was less of a strategy move and more of just a reactionary emotional move.
All right. So we go to this tribal council where you are going to have this close call. You would have been voted out. David is going to play the idol on you. What was the bigger shock to you that, oh, I am about to be voted out of the game, or that David is going to play his idol on you?
Both.
I can't imagine.
Yeah, it was a horrible moment. And it was not a proud survivor moment either for me, just because it really is one of those circumstances where you've looked at a situation and you've tried to determine what's going to happen. And the determination I came to was incorrect, because I was relying on my relationship with Sunday and making that determination. And then I had this person sitting here almost with his heart on his sleeve telling me, I'm being completely 100% truthful with you and you're not believing me. And it was one of those situations, I think, which is a perfect example of what Survivor can do to mess with your emotions, because I literally had two people sitting right next to me telling me completely opposite things, and I had to pick one of them. I had to pick one. And if you pick wrong, then you can be damaging your game moving forward. And I picked wrong. And so it's a perfect representation of Survivor and how it really messes with you on every single level, because I did have to make a choice. And I am extremely grateful that David decided to save me. I think that David's decision to save me was a great strategic move for him. And he saw that if I save her, I will have someone who will be very loyal to me, someone who will be in my group and will probably never want to vote me out because of that loyalty factor. And also someone who, if I sit next to in the final three, I win because I saved her. So there was all of these really great components of it for David. Obviously, I felt like a boob. it was really close. But it really, it was a moment where seeing your name come up on the parchment is hard enough. But knowing that none of it, I mean, it's a surreal moment because David stands up obviously and says, I'm going to be playing this. And I'm sitting there processing going, what is happening? Because you're trying to figure out what he's doing. And it was he made a very good show of it and an explanation that some people are going to be very upset, but he was playing it for me. And in that moment, I think that's when I realized I was absolutely in trouble. Like that was it. That like I wasn't being played with. Like, yeah, I was in trouble. And then to see my name come up so many times was extremely hard to see. But then knowing it didn't count and knowing I completely made the wrong choice and I picked the wrong side and I voted for Cece, and it didn't make any sense when people saw it on television why I voted for Cece. But I voted for Cece because that's what Sunday was telling me to do. And that's what, you know, the closest ally I had in the game was telling me to do. And so it was not one of my finer moments.
Yeah, but you had a near-death experience and you survived it.
I did. So I was very grateful.
But the thing that was always confusing to us was that you had this moment with David saving you, but then right after that, the next episode starts and we see you telling Ken about the legacy advantage and says, hey, Ken, if anything happens to me, I want you to have the legacy advantage. But yeah. It was certainly felt weird that, okay, David, but then, hey, Ken, here's the legacy advantage.
And this is exactly why I did that. I knew that David was going to keep me in that game no matter what because of the move that he just made. He didn't save me to do anything other than, I think, help his game strategically. I mean, that was a move for David as far as rebuilding a group of people that were going to be loyal to him. He already had Ken, and he was kind of on the outs with everyone else. He hadn't really found, you know, his place yet within the group. But if he saved me, now he has a group of three, and he has someone who is going to be exceptionally loyal to him and is probably not going to vote him out. And it was a great strategic move for him as far as bettering his own game. And I knew that. When we came back after the tribal council, I talked to David, I thanked him. And he said to me, he said, well, I want to keep you in this game. I wanted to keep you in this game and I want to keep you in this game. And so I thought, okay, he's with me. Like he's going to be with me. But Ken was very angry and very upset with me. And I knew I couldn't move forward in the game if I only had one person on my side. That's not going to happen. You need a group. You definitely need a group of people. And so that's why I went to Ken, because Ken was very angry with me and very upset. And he had tried to save me. And so I had to give him credit for what he had tried to do. He had come to me with information and said, listen, Lucy wants to vote you out. They're telling me to vote you out. And I didn't believe him. I needed to show him that I can play this game with you and you can trust me, because I knew at that point there was no love for me on the other side. I, you know, Chris and Brett and Sunday and, you know, and Cece, they were very upset with me. And I knew, I'm like, I need help. Like I need a lifeline here. Mm-hmm. And so my lifeline was going to come from Ken. And so that's why I went to Ken and said, listen, I've got this legacy, and I told him about it and I promised it to him so I could regain his trust and his loyalty, which ended up working. And it worked out extremely well, because then once we had the swap, obviously he was the one that I was still on a tribe with. So it did work out well in that regard. But that was why I did it. And because I knew, I'm like, David's going to have my back moving forward. And David said to me multiple times in that game, I will do anything to keep you in this game. Those were David's words. And so I knew David had an interest in keeping me around because it was better for his game. I needed Ken to better my own game.
Okay, so let's talk swap. So you go to Tikali, or you stayed where you were, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tribe name.
Yes.
I have that right?
Mm-hmm, yes.
What a good memory. What a good job I made. really impressed. And it's Tikali, Ikabula, and, you know, I couldn't tell you what the other one was. But so you stay there with Ken, and then you were joined by Adam and Figtails, Figgy, and Taylor. Do you and Ken feel like your goose is cooked here?
It was an interesting ride back to the tribe, back to camp, because I was looking at our group and kind of sizing all of us up. Now, in one hand, I thought this was great for me because I wasn't with Chris and Brett and Sunday. So I thought that's good because they're all angry with me. And I was with Ken and I thought, well, that's good because Ken is back on my side. But yeah, now we're in the minority. There's two of us, there's three of them. But when I was looking at the group of five, I knew Adam was going to be the person I would need. Adam was going to be my guy. Like, I needed to get to work with Adam in order to have him kind of join forces with Ken and I, because I could see that Figgy and Taylor were very close. So Adam was going to be that swing vote. And I realized that right away. And it was almost immediate that Adam and I went to talk when we got back to camp. And both of us said straight up, I want to work with you. I mean, it was almost immediate that we both made that determination. And I think because we both saw the benefit of bringing the other one in case he wanted to work with Taylor and Figgy, he would be able to, and he could have me. And on my end, if, you know, he would come in and work with Ken and I, then we would have the majority. So he was very early on, you know, the swing vote in that, but he was definitely someone that in order to save our game, I thought that, yes, I would need Adam. But I also thought that if they were going to vote anyone out, I know Adam thought that I seemed concerned and paranoid that I would be the one on the chopping block. But I thought for sure it would be Ken. If it came down between the two of us, even though Ken was great in challenges and he was obviously, you know, very good at, you know, catching food and doing all of those things, as far as strategically in the game, if you decide as a millennial that you don't want to work with the Gen Xers, Ken is more of a threat than I am moving forward if you're trying to take out larger threats before you get to the merge. You know, that he's more of a physical threat than I am. So I thought I might be okay. And then I started having some really good conversations with Figgy. So I thought, okay, I think I'm all right. But now I need to keep Ken safe as well. And that became my goal, was keeping Ken safe and getting Adam to join us and vote out Taylor or Figgy.
And how much did you sense that, of course, with the couple, Figgy and Taylor, you knew about the showmance there. But when did the idea start to come up of, okay, they're together, but maybe this person who's the third wheel, we can flip him against the couple?
Oh, well, that was a really interesting conversation I had with Adam, because we had our first conversation of, yes, I want to work with you and you want to work with me. And then we had another conversation later, and Adam's view was, we need to vote out Ken and you should join forces with Figgy and Taylor and I. And I immediately shot that down and said, no, we need to keep Ken, and had to convince Adam why keeping Ken was the better move moving forward. And we talked a lot about the relationship between Figgy and Taylor as we saw it, and how close they were when they were, you know, with the millennials, and how they could affect the millennials moving forward, and all of these things. So it was definitely something that I knew we needed to put a kibosh on as far as the relationship between Figgy and Taylor was concerned. So I think, you know, Adam being the swing vote, that was almost immediate that we saw that was going to be a necessary component of it.
You guys win the first immunity challenge when you're together as a group, but eventually things are going to not go your way in that second immunity challenge that you guys are going to face together. Adam talked about how that there were some signals that were being sent to him by Michaela specifically, who was also sort of helping out Zeke and Michelle with the puzzle. Did you pick up any of the stuff that was going on the beach that day?
Oh, the whole, I didn't see the signals. Adam shared that with me later. He told me that that's what they were doing before we ended up voting for Figgy. But when I saw Michaela, like, openly, vocally helping Zeke and Michelle, I thought, this is bad. Like, this is really bad because clearly they don't want us to win. And that was frustrating. But I wasn't sure what their ultimate goal was. And I believe Michaela even said, you know, when Jeff asked her about why she was doing that, she's like, well, if they can't do math, then, you know, one of them should go home. It was something along those lines, you know. So it was like she sounded like it's 3-2. You know what you got to do. Mm-hmm. If you can't figure it out, well, then you shouldn't be playing the game. So I didn't get the sense that they wanted Figgy to go home. It wasn't until we got back to camp and Adam and I started talking, and he had given us a little bit of an insight concerning the first couple of votes and what had happened as far as Mari and the issues that Figgy was having. So we did get a sense that there was some stuff going on the millennial camp and with the millennials themselves. But it was one of those situations that became more clear once we got back and Adam started to share with me, this is what I was being told to do. And I really started working very heavily on Adam with, let's vote out Figgy then. And, you know, let's do this and let's not vote out Ken, because obviously Taylor and Figgy were pushing him very hard to vote out Ken. And so there was a lot of, I mean, there was multiple conversations going on, because Figgy and Taylor were telling me to vote out Adam, and they were telling Ken to vote out Adam, and we would be like 4 strong and we could get rid of Adam. But then they were talking to Adam about voting out Ken, and Ken and I were talking to Adam about voting out Figgy. So there was all of these weird conversations. And then when you're like all sitting together, you're not having those conversations anymore. But it was an interesting lead up to tribal council, because I was really hoping that we had convinced Adam that he should vote with us. And it wasn't until there was a moment in tribal council where Adam said that tonight one person is going to leave very upset and one person is going to go back to camp very angry, that I knew he was going to be voting with us, because that fell in prop, like it fit perfectly as far as the relationship between Figgy and Taylor, with someone being very upset and someone being very angry, that it was going to be Figgy going home.
Was there any doubt that Adam was going to be voting with you in that spot?
I had some doubt, just because when you're a swing vote, you don't know what the other side has promised him. I had no idea what type of conversations Figgy and Taylor were having with Adam. And I was relying on information that I didn't know other than what Adam was telling me from what had happened on the millennial camp. And Figgy and Taylor were obviously downplaying, I think, a lot of the issues that they had with the other millennials, I think, in order to make it appear as if they were in control, and telling Ken and I, we're going to run the show. Come the merge, you know, if the 4 of us are together, we've got Jay and we've got Michelle and we've got all of these other people that we can work with. So it was one of those situations where I was hoping that Adam would. And the only reason why I thought Adam might not was because Ken had kind of rubbed Adam the wrong way. Ken and he weren't necessarily getting along at one point. And there was one part where you saw where I told Ken, I'm like, you need to go and talk to Adam and make sure that you tell him you're with him 100%. Otherwise, you know, we're going to have a problem. And I did that without telling Ken that Adam had mentioned voting out Ken. And I did that on purpose, because I didn't want Ken to then think that Adam was voting for him. I just wanted them to mend the relationship that they had, as opposed to, he's gunning for you, so you need to go work your magic. It was more like, just go talk to him and make sure that you guys are good and he knows that you're solid. And thank God it worked, because, you know, it was one of those situations where I was like, oh, you know, it's I really did have to fight to save Ken in that moment. And it was great that Adam recognized the benefit to not only solidifying and unifying himself with Gen Xers, but then at the same time, because of what he had been told on the mat in voting out Figgy, he had the millennials on the other side as well. So it had obviously helped him out as well.
And it was lucky that Ken didn't give him a test.
Well, yes. And, you know, that's one of those situations where I think with Ken, if I had told Ken, Adam wants to vote you out, Ken's response to that would not have been what you then saw, where he went and had a very genuine conversation with Adam. it would have been a much different conversation. And so that was why I never told Ken that Adam was talking about voting you out, because I knew that it would affect the conversation in a manner that would not be beneficial to myself or to Adam. And at that point in time, Adam was a key component in moving forward, and we needed to have him on our side. And so I didn't want Ken to feel offended in any fashion.
Okay, so after Figgy is gone, we saw some conversation between you and Ken and Taylor about potentially going with him instead of Adam. Now, we've learned how close you are with Adam. Were you guys just stringing him along, or was there any talk about potentially working with Taylor at some point?
I think we really just were keeping our options open, but as far as who we could truly work with and feel like we had the ability to work with, Adam was clearly the better choice of the two, because Taylor's a funny guy. He's very entertaining. He's a nice guy, but he was one of those people that we were nervous moving forward, knowing he had, you know, the close relationships he did with Jay, and we didn't know where he was going to fall come emerge. And it was one of those situations where Taylor was so angry at Adam that I think a lot of his promises to us were coming out of anger. And that's why he was shaking our hand, saying, "I'll never write your name down. You know, you work with me." So I think it was just a more of keeping our options open. And Ken and I had a lot of conversations about that.
All right. So finally, you guys get back to the merge after Michaela goes home. We get to see the reunion of the Gen X Alliance. And there are fractures, because the last time that you guys were all together, that was when there was the vote to try to take you out, and David played his idol to save you, and you've all sort of like gone your own separate ways, but now end up back together. And we didn't really get to see a lot of that. At the beginning of the merge, we saw a lot about how the guys are hanging out, but was there any sort of conversation between the six Gen Xers that are there about, hey, are we all going to work together, or is it all just sort of, you know, you and your voting block / trust cluster, and then it just came together like one big group?
Yeah, when we got back, one of the first things I did was try to go to Sunday to say like, hey, you know, what's going on? Where are we at? I was very nervous to see Brett and Chris and Sunday again, because I didn't know where they were all going to be head-wise and moving forward and wanting to play the game with me. But I did not get a good vibe from any of them. I mean, Sunday was, we were chatting, but it wasn't like it had been when the game first started. Brett actually came up to me and he gave me a hug. He's like, let's just move past all that stuff and we'll be fine. And I was like, okay. And, you know, Chris definitely seemed like he was harboring some resentment for me. So it was a situation where I knew that those three were going to be a problem. And I had had discussions with Adam about that moving forward. I wasn't sure where we were going to be with the other Gen Xers. So Adam was at least aware that there was some animosity. And so I really had to kind of sit back and see how those relationships were going to develop. And it's one of those circumstances where you pay very close attention to, you know, obviously who's hanging out with who, where people are sleeping at night, and who they're actually spending a significant amount of time with. And Brett and Chris and Sunday were immediately like together, very close right away, sleeping together by the fire. And I knew that I'm like, great, now I have this other three that is, I think, going to be gunning for me at some point. So I just had to be very aware of the situation, because we really didn't have a, you know, let's just sit down and chat and work past this, because I did not get the sense at all from Chris that he had any interest in fixing anything with me.
But yet you guys all voted together on that first couple of votes for Michelle and Taylor. Did you guys have any sort of like group talk, or was it all just like telephone game of, okay, this is what we're doing tonight, and everybody just put this name down?
No, it was interesting, because when we got back right after the merge, one of the first conversations I had with Michelle was, we were laying on the hammock together, and she looked at me and said, "Why am I being told you're the most dangerous strategic player out here and we need to vote you out?" And so
good
I said,
question.
Oh, yeah. I'm like, really? That's interesting. Okay. So I knew I was going to have to do damage control. And I knew, I'm like, that's got to be coming from Chris and his camp, because where else is it coming from? So I explained to her what had happened in regards to, you know, the Polvo and the Lucy and playing the idol. And she was like, oh, well, that makes a lot of sense. And so Michelle understood what had happened at that point. But then I knew, I'm like, all right, there's some issues here. And when we went into that first actual challenge after the merge, I had heard my name multiple times that I was on the chopping block. And so I thought, awesome, you know, we get to the merge and here I am, I'm already a target, all because, you know, we never were able to get past an issue that we had back on Tecali. So I was very, very nervous going into that first challenge. And I knew I needed to win because I was convinced that I was going to be voted for. Unfortunately, I didn't know that Adam had shared Will's name with anybody. And I found out afterwards from Will that if he hadn't been told that his name had been mentioned, that he wouldn't have stayed as long as he did. I mean, I think when you are in this game and you hear your name, it gives you so much more strength and desire to stand there forever and win this challenge, because you need to save your life in the game. Really, that's what it boils down to. So he knew that his name was on the chopping block. I had heard that my name was on the chopping block. So we were both trying to win that immunity challenge. And when we got back, I was devastated because I thought for sure that was it. I was done. And Zeke asked me to go for a walk with him to get some water. And Adam came along and Zeke informed me. He said, okay, just so you know, you're not being voted for anymore tonight. And I was like, what? Like, what are you talking about? What's happening? And he said, well, now they're gunning for Adam because of, you know, Adam started talking about voting at Will. And that was where I was filled in with all of the Will stuff. And that was the first time Adam was finding out he might be in trouble because he had mentioned Will's name. So it was one of those, you know, those crazy situations where from that moment on, I knew that there was no fixing this situation, but we at least did come together because there were people within our group like David and Zeke and Adam, and, you know, and he and Taylor had been talking. So we at least had enough of an overlap of individuals who had relationships with Chris, you know, where David was talking to Chris and he had a relationship with Chris, and, you know, Adam had a relationship with Zeke, and Zeke was in close with Chris. And, you know, so it was at least there was enough people that there was enough overlap so we could all share information. And so that first vote, that was kind of how it came down, was that there was enough sharing of information amongst the little groups that we were able to come to the agreement that we would vote out Michelle. Mm-hmm. When it came to the Taylor vote, It was almost funny. Like now I think back and I laugh about it a little bit. I love that. Because like when we were making a decision about who we were going to vote for that night, obviously we all knew about Taylor and some of the things he was doing as far as the food and things were a little obnoxious there. But like, I remember being like beckoned over by Chris to go and chat on the beach. And there was a group of us like chatting together on the beach. And it's one of those situations where you're having a conversation with someone about, okay, we're going to be voting out Taylor next, and everyone's talking about it. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, Chris just wants to vote me out. He just can't do it yet. Like, I just knew. I'm like, I just knew that it was like we put on this facade for each other. Like, we're going to be cordial, and we're going to talk, and we're going to work together. But I'm just waiting to stab you in the back. You know, that I kind of just got that vibe from him, that read on it.
Eventually, the great Gen X Civil War is going to come to the surface. We saw during the Taylor vote that Sunday and Brett are at least having conversations about, hey, is it time to get rid of Jessica? But the first shot is going to end up being fired in the Gen X Civil War. And it seems like simultaneously, Chris is saying, you know what, this is the time we have to get rid of Jessica. And then we see on the David side, okay, we need to start to get rid of Chris. So could you take us through how this all starts to unfold from your perspective?
Yes, I was actually told by David, because David was playing a very good middle game. No one really knew how close that that David and I necessarily were. I was close with Ken, and obviously he was close with David, but David had formed a pretty good relationship with Chris while they were together. And because of that relationship, he was receiving information, and David had learned that they were wanting to vote me out. So David had brought to me that bit of information that, hey, listen, they're coming for you and it's going to be this vote. So I knew at that point in time that something needed to happen. I was willing to wait and not vote out Chris so soon. But at the same time, obviously, now they're gunning for me. So something needs to happen. And then I went to Adam and shared the information with Adam. And Adam's response was the same. He's like, I didn't want to do this so soon. Like, I thought we could, you know, last a little bit longer before we needed to do this. And I was hoping that we'd be able to do that as well. But unfortunately, it was a decision that was kind of set in motion because Chris had mentioned it to David. And then, you know, it got back to me. And so I said, all right, we have to vote for Chris. So it was one of those circumstances where you had to be really careful with the information sharing, because obviously Chris had relationships with people like Zeke and with David. David was sharing information with us. We were sharing information with Zeke. We had kind of formed this like little group of, I believe Zeke called it Revenge of the Nerds, where it was the people who had been targeted or voted for or kind of on the bottom, we were all going to come together and have this Revenge of the Nerds. And so that felt good because I thought, okay, we've got Zeke and he's sharing information with us too. And he's able to determine what's going on with Chris because he's sharing information with Chris and Chris is doing the same. So I saw that as a benefit because there was enough feelers out there to determine that, yes, this was actually happening. And, you know, we needed to get rid of Chris at that point. And I think that enough people saw that as the better move for their game because he is, you know, he is a bigger guy and strategically, you know, he's a thinker and he was playing that game hard. And, you know, overall, I think that Zeke and David really had to decide at that point, when I do this, I'm almost, not that I'm drawing a line in the sand, but I'm showing people where my loyalties lie. And once I vote out Chris, I might have to mend fences or I might just be done as far as, you know, that group of people is concerned, because there were factions and there were little groups. And so, you know, that was one of those situations where I was very thankful that I had someone like David and Zeke who were able to get the information they needed and share it with us. And then when we went to that first, when we went to the immunity challenge before Chris was voted out, there was such a sigh of relief for me when I saw Chris drop his statue. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, good. Like, all right, like that's good, because that means that, you know, he's not safe for tonight's vote. And so, you know, that definitely worked out well in my favor, but I didn't have long to enjoy that moment.
No, no. All right. So eventually Chris is going to go home. Zeke is going to be on board with you guys. But then very shortly thereafter, we end up where Zeke is going to reverse course and then try to work with the people that were with Chris, pick them up, and then come after David. So were you getting a sense that this was unfolding in the days leading up to that vote?
I was. And this is the another part that I find really incredibly impressive as far as Zeke is concerned, because, you know,
impressive or oppressive?
Impressive.
Okay.
Impressive that he was able to go back to Brett and immediately get Brett back in his good graces just kind of blows my mind, because Brett was someone who seemed to be very interested in that loyalty component. And, you know, even though a lot of what Brett has said, it's strange because, like, he said the comment about it's hard to trust someone who's voted against you, but Sunday voted against him and he took Sunday back. Zeke voted against him when he voted out Chris, but then he took Zeke back. And so it was a really great call for Zeke to immediately recognize that I can still get Brett back, even if I get out his closest ally right now.
But in fairness, what else was he going to do, you know?
Well, and that's true, too. So, but it's one of those situations where I feel like it wasn't necessary that that we divide in that fashion at that point. Zeke was in a fine place with our six. We had, I think, a very strong six moving forward. And I really do think that, like the straw that broke the camel's back, I think was, I mean, Hannah was a component of it, but also David said to Sunday and Brett, Zeke is a you know, a really big threat in this game. And that, I think, really kind of set things in motion as well, because he mentioned it to Brett, who had already formed this relationship with Zeke that he might, you know, David might not have been completely aware of. But you have to be very careful with who you say those things to, because that kind of set things in motion. I think if, you know, we could have, all of that could have been avoided if people had just kind of calmed down and taken a breath and not realized that they needed to pick sides. But it really did feel like at that moment you had to pick a side. And I don't, to me, that wasn't necessarily, it didn't need to happen. Everybody had a side, if you will. Everybody, you know, Zeke was on our side. Adam was on our side. Brett was not on our side. You know, but we had enough people that we could have just continued to move forward. I mean, there were six of us. And so we could have just moved forward with the six. But, you know, once that name drop happened, and once there was this idea that Zeke and David were gunning for each other, then that really, I think, just set everything in motion. And I went into that tribal council being really, really worried, because I was like, I don't know what's going to happen tonight. I went back to Zeke multiple times that day to try to figure out where his head was at, and I couldn't figure it out. And he kept kind of spinning, you know, oh, we're going to do what we said. We're going to split the votes, and we're, you know, this is who we're going to vote for. And none of it made sense. And I really was struggling with where Zeke's head was at. But I think that was part of my problem, was I was focusing too much on where Zeke's head was at and not necessarily looking at the entire picture, because I didn't go into it thinking, if we go to Rocks, I'm going to be super duper confident about this, because I was hoping that we were going to actually have the numbers by the time, you know, the end rolled around and we all voted. But unfortunately, that's not what happened.
Yeah, that actually leads to a question I was going to ask, is so leading up to that vote, we have heard that Zeke prepared his side for the draw. He, you know, he got him hyped up, you know, go to that rock draw. And I thought that I had heard from others on your side that, you know, a lot of them felt it was coming, even if it wasn't all hyped up. Was there any discussion among your side of, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to really just go in there and stick our hand in a bag?
No. And I wish there had been. I really do. Because I think that it was one of those situations where, even though, like, David thought that we might be going to Rocks and Adam thought we might be going to Rocks, and I was hoping that we were going to be, that we would end up with six, you know, in the end, and that there that six of us would come together. I wish that we had had that conversation, because one, I would have told everybody how crazy they all were that we were even having that conversation. But also, I think that was part of my downfall, was that I really was, that moment was so awful when I'm sitting there and having this realization that this is what it's going to come to, and not wanting to pick Rocks. And it would have been a fantastic conversation to have with people and kind of remind them where they were in the game. If you look at Zeke's group that he had formed and put together, they are voting for Hannah, someone who most, if not all, of the people that are in Zeke's group could be in the final three. None of those people are beating Zeke in the final three at that point in the game. And to me, that should have been a huge realization to them, that if you really had to pick between Zeke and Hannah, who do you want to sit next to in the final three? And why are you putting your game on the line for someone who is ultimately going to beat you in the final three? And that was such a struggle I had sitting there, was the craziness of it, where if you have to pick between Zeke and Hannah for your own personal game, who's the better choice to go home? It's not Zeke, it's Hannah at that point. I mean, it's not Hannah, it's Zeke, but it's one of those situations where for some reason they had all kind of dug in their heels and were going to, you know, really represent Zeke and stay with Zeke, even though I don't think it was the best call for their game moving forward.
So you feel like that you could have, if you would have known how it was going to be a 5-5 tie leading up to that tribal council, you could have flipped one of the people from that side by telling them that Zeke was a bigger threat to keeping the game than Hannah?
Yes, and I also think it would have been a perfect opportunity for me to say, hey, I got this legacy thing here.
Who would you have targeted? Who would you have gotten to flip?
Oh, I think it Will would have been the person I would have talked to. Because obviously I didn't have a good relationship with Brett and Sunday. You know, they were not individuals who I think were on my side. Jay, I think I might have been able to talk to Jay, but he was one of those individuals that I also saw as a threat in the game moving forward. So do I really want to give him a legacy and advantage on day 36? But he at least was talking to me leading up to that vote, you know, where I was having conversations with him. I was talking to Zeke, trying to kind of figure out where everyone was at. But he was kind of he was an unknown. We weren't sure necessarily where Jay's loyalties lie, because he kind of seemed to be in a different. I mean, he was obviously had been with Brett and Sunday for a while, so I wasn't really sure how their relationship was. But I think out of everyone, I think Will could have been the one person that I could have talked to and tried to convince to do something different, just because Will and I had had a good relationship and we had talked a lot about moving forward in the game together. And he was someone who was kind of the seventh person in our six at one point. So I thought, you know, he might have been someone that I definitely could have spoken to and possibly made a deal with. But I really didn't realize it had come to such a hard division at that point.
Yeah, you mentioned Will, and, you know, we later found out that he has said, you know, that he would have flipped if he didn't think you were going to. So, you know, and then, of course, he did flip on the very next vote. So in your discussions with him, there was no hint of that possibility leading up to the vote?
No, and I think that it was one of those situations where that day felt so weird. And, you know, after we got back from the immunity challenge, we had to get dinner ready because we didn't know what time we were going to be going. And I had said, you know, I'll open up some coconuts. So I turned around and, you know, and it was like, everything was just, it was so eerie. Like, it was just such an eerie day that, like, the whole thing was, I think eerie is the best word for it. Because once I started chopping coconuts, I got like three opened and I turned around and the entire camp was barren except David. Everybody was gone. And I was in shock, and I walked over to David and he's like, Jessica, you have to do me a favor. And that's when he told me about, you know, we have to vote for Zeke. And I said, I'm like, what is happening? Like, what is going on? And then we brought Ken in on the conversation and David was like, we have to vote for Zeke. You know, I'm being targeted. And so everything from that moment, just it almost felt like you were walking on eggshells because you didn't know who was on what side at that point. Because Zeke had been with us. Zeke had been playing the game with us and had been working in our group of six. And so we thought for sure that we were going to be in a good place. And so the rest of that afternoon, every conversation you had, you almost felt like you had to be so careful with what you said, because there was so many different versions of what was going to be happening. There was the conversation that everyone was having as to, we're going to vote out this person, which is like, there's the fake story, and then there's the cover story for the fake story of who you're going to vote out. And there was so many things that were up in the air that it really, I felt like we were all walking on eggshells to try to figure out what was actually going to be happening that night. I don't know if any of that just made sense.
Yeah. At what point are you aware that it's going to be a tie? Is it when the votes are read?
I think it was, obviously, yeah, I knew for sure at that point we were done. But I think that I had gone into that tribal council hoping that we had Will. That's what I think I had gone in hoping, that we had Will and that we would have six. And that was my hope. So then once we actually started to see the votes and as they're being read, you know, that suddenly became less and less possible. I mean, obviously it would have been 6-4. So you're just kind of waiting to see what the final tally is going to be. But at that moment, yeah, then I absolutely knew for sure that we were deadlocked at that point.
Jeff says that this is a tie. We all see the expression on your face. Is there anything that you could tell us about what your thought process was during that moment?
It was a horrible situation to be in because you're processing so much. And it's almost like your brain slows down, even though everything is moving so quickly around you, because you're trying to work out all of these different ideas in your head and different analogies or different possibilities and different algorithms and all of these things. Like, where am I going to fall as far as this vote is concerned? And what do I do moving forward? But obviously time is continuing to move and Jeff is there and he's keeping everything moving forward. And so you're fighting against so many things at that point, because you just kind of want to tell everybody to stop and like, let's just stop everything and let's all process, because there was so many people saying things and yelling things and there was accusations and different things happening, and trying to get a group of people like that to agree is impossible. No one is going to agree. I mean, we all had to agree, or someone had to flip. You know, there needed to be some decision made, but there was such a hard line that had been drawn at that point that I knew if I flip at this point, I am going to be basically joining, and I'm using air quotes when I say that, people who had just tried to vote me out, the tribal council previously. So that side, there was no love for me over there. If I flip, I'm going to be giving up the loyalty that I have now earned with Adam and David and Ken. And so where does that put me in this game once I lose that loyalty? And I join forces with a group of people that just wanted to vote me out. So I didn't want to have to flip, but I didn't want to have to pick rocks. So my brain was a wreck at that point, because it's one of those moments where you realize I just really have to, I have to play the numbers. I have to try to take a chance, because if I at least go to rocks, I can walk back to that camp, hopefully, because I don't pick the black rock, in the same situation that I was before I walked into this tribal council, where I still have the loyalty that I had to these people before, and I haven't turned my back on those people. And then I'm staying true to those people. And I don't have to go back into a camp and make excuses about why I flipped and why I ended up not going to rocks. Because not going to rocks, I think, would have affected anybody's game moving forward. Because at that point, flipping wasn't being respected. If you look at who's being voted for, Hannah was being voted for because she had flipped on Zeke. We were voting for Zeke because he had flipped on us. And obviously, I had seen what had happened back on Takali when I had voted out Paul, you know, and the response that garnered. And so there's all of these things that you're kind of playing in your head, and you're trying to determine, where does this put my end game? And I, even though I was sick at the idea of going to rocks and that might take me out of the game, I knew that the flipping component was going to be worse for my game if I ended up making it to the final three, because I might be sitting next to someone who was willing to go to rocks, and they'd have a great argument as to why, you know, I took the easy route basically and I flipped, Or there'd be people sitting on the jury that were like, I was willing to go to Rocks and you weren't. And there's all of these things that you're kind of running through in your head. And I just knew at that point where my game was at, where I had come from back, you know, onto Kali and the Paul issue and being saved by David, I could not flip because the loyalty that I had now achieved with these three people, with Adam and Ken and David, was so important. I could not lose that loyalty. And that was my struggle sitting there.
Yeah. And I think that part of the reason that there was this debate at the time was what we saw on TV was not what you saw in the game regarding flipping not being respected, because what we saw on TV was voting blocks, trust clusters, swirling alliances. And at least that's what it appeared to be on TV. And so people were like, well, she could have just flipped over and gone back the next time. It wouldn't have been that big a deal.
Right.
But what you're saying is that's not the way it was.
No, because it really did greatly affect how people perceived you in the game. And it did put a target on you for the next vote. And it even though I do think that the game is always moving and there are opportunities that you can, you know, you could, you know, the whole old saying, you can make lemonade, you know, if you have some lemons and you kind of have to do that. And I had to do that way back at the beginning when all of a sudden everyone had kind of tossed me aside. And I then formed a relationship with Ken and David, which was great. But I don't think that it's one of those situations where as the game was moving forward and as it was developing, that there was a respect for that type of gameplay. And I think that's why a lot of people struggled with Hannah, was because that was more of her gameplay, was you never knew where she was coming from. And there seems to be a benefit when you're working with someone that you don't have to question what they're going to do and question how they're going to do it. And so if you formed a relationship, a very close bond with someone, and you now have that basis with them to then turn around and not be true to it is detrimental. And I had a situation specifically with Ken when I gained his trust back, when I gained his belief in me after I promised him the legacy. I mean, he told me point blank. He said, don't ever do this again. Like, don't do it again. Because I'm now trusting you. Don't break that. And I knew if I were to flip, I would have broken all of that trust that I had worked so hard to rebuild.
Jess, one of the fun things about talking about this now is that we know how the whole season is going to play out. In your mind, who made the wrong move by not flipping that night?
I think Will did. I mean, if Will's intention was to start playing this pendulum game, why he decided to not begin the pendulum game at a moment where he's putting his hand in a bag of rocks is, I think, the wrong move for Will. Because if you are going to walk into the next vote and flip sides and have this idea that this is how your game is going to now play out, this is pendulum swinging, I think not putting your hand in a bag of rocks is a better time to start that game. Like, to avoid that, if that's really what your idea is for your game moving forward, then yeah, I think that Will would have been better off flipping and avoiding going to Rocks, because I think Will was still close enough to people in our group that I think it wouldn't have affected his game so much, just because he had been kind of our outside, you know, we had the six and he was kind of like the seventh. And I think he could have finagled his way back in. But I didn't think I was in that situation at all. And so I think at that moment, if someone were to flip, I think Will would have been a better idea for him to flip then as opposed to when he did. Because when he did flip, he kind of highlighted himself at that moment and made himself a swing vote and made himself, you know, a very important integral piece of the puzzle when he didn't necessarily need to do that. And then he ended up, you know, getting himself voted out for it because he called such attention to it. I think if he had flipped when we went to Rocks, he could have at least said, well, I did this because I still have a relationship with these people. Or I think he could have spun it in a fashion that it would have been better for him. But I think we all made a mistake because we let it go to a tie.
So. Yeah.
We all screwed up. How about that?
Well, I think that somewhere along the way, I think that there's an interesting lesson in sort of, you know, conflict management and resolution and dealing with things before they ultimately come to a head. But that's a story for another podcast, Jess. So when you get to Ponderosa, how are things with Chris?
Things were okay. I mean, we obviously realized we were both lawyers, so that was funny. You know,
did you tell him, hey, Ken really hates lawyers, just so you know?
I did share that story with them as well. I think everyone at Ponderosa was looking forward to when I was going to mention that to Ken in the final three. But we got along well, we didn't click, I don't think, as well as I clicked with other people. I mean, he and I definitely got along well. We joked a lot. We laughed a lot, had a good time. But yeah, I mean, I think there's just some underlying thing between the two of us that, you know, and I don't know if it's because we're both attorneys, I'm not sure, but he's a great guy. And we definitely did have a lot of fun when we were together in Ponderosa. But yeah, I think it's just a different type of relationship that he and I formed, because there is a lot of, you revisit and you replay and you go over a lot of things. And I think Chris blames me for a lot of the manner in which he ended up exiting the game. I think he blames me very heavily for.
So you don't think it's because he's a defense attorney and you're a prosecutor?
No, I think that, you know, maybe there's some underlying things there that, you know, we both have this sense of each other and that we're both, you know, strong individuals who are willing to fight for, you know, whatever we are representing at that time. And maybe if that affects it, it might, you know, subconsciously affect it. But I think ultimately it's more of a, I think he was still a little upset with his time in the game and how it came to an end, and that I was a component of that.
So as the game continued to go on and you're going to tribal council after tribal council, what was something that happened that really surprised you as you were watching the whole game unfold from the jury?
That they never voted David out until fourth. that was one thing that I think surprised all of us. Before we would go to tribal council, we all kind of guessed who we thought was going to be going home and who we thought was going to win immunity. And if anyone was going to play an idol, you know, we try to figure these things out. And I think we were always surprised every time David made it another vote, because he really was playing such a phenomenal game and really had kind of pushed everyone, I think, you know, to play the game even harder because of how he was playing the game. And the fact that he kept making it through another vote, I think, was really shocking to all of us.
So ultimately, when David does go home, then how much is it a foregone conclusion from the juror's perspective that Adam is going to be the winner of the season?
Once it was that final three, it was Adam was going to win. And I think there was one thing that I had heard about in the, you know, why Adam won. And there was some mention about Hannah and that she thinks that part of the reason why she lost was because she was a woman. And that truly had nothing to do with the determination that we all made. I think that Hannah played the game in a fashion that we didn't really all understand. You know, she did make moves, but she made moves, I think, just for the sake of making moves, even though they weren't necessarily the right moves. And I think, you know, a large a good representation of that was when, you know, she wanted to vote out Sunday. And as far as her ability to win that game, if there was anyone she could potentially beat, it might have been Sunday. And to vote out the one person that you might have a chance of beating in the final three, we didn't really understand, you know, like what her ultimate game play was and what her idea was as far as, you know, winning Survivor would be. And so I think it, you know, in Hannah's mind, maybe she thought she was playing a better game than she was, but we all thought Hannah was a little all over the place. And she's a sweet girl, you know, really fun, but, you know, and very quirky, but also someone who, you just didn't really always know where she was coming from. You know, and the David and Zeke issue is a large representation of that, as far as her choosing to play with David when she didn't necessarily need to even make that choice. She was playing with both Zeke and David, and there was no reason to even make a choice at that point because we were all in a six together. And so adding to any division and causing a rift between David and Zeke was a really bad choice for Hannah, because it wasn't necessary. And I think that that was why everyone was always kind of questioning where Hannah was coming from, because the things that she did didn't make sense.
But I'm curious that you were so tight with Ken, and ultimately he's going to get shut out. But did you consider giving him a vote at all?
He had about, I think it was like an 80-20. You know, it's like, as far as I'm going to vote for Adam. But what I wanted Ken to be able to do, and I asked him the question I asked him, which they didn't show everything that I mean, I spoke to both Adam and Ken because I think they're both incredible people, and I have so much respect for the both of them. Adam obviously played a more strategic game, but I wanted to give Ken an opportunity to try to explain why he voted out David. Because someone who had been playing such a loyal game and emphasizing how important loyalty was, to then vote out the one person that he was the most loyal to for the whole game, needed an explanation. And so I gave him an opportunity to give that explanation. And I was hoping that his explanation would be that that was his strategy throughout the entire game. You know, that he was going to play with David, that he was going to utilize David to play the game, and that that was his strategy, that he knew he was going to have to vote out David. And he did it in the manner that he did because that was part of his strategy, that I'm going to use this guy who's playing such a great game to further my game, and then I'm going to get rid of him when I have the chance to do so. That would have, I think, impressed people, because he would have talked about strategy, but he didn't talk about strategy in that moment. And a lot of, you know, the answers that Ken provided, it wasn't necessarily about strategy. And so, you know, I was hoping for that like moment for Ken where he would just all of a sudden come out and say, this was it, and this is how I play the game, and this is why I did it. But he was very much on the defensive about his game. And I think that, you know, that affected his ability as well to really answer questions, because I think he probably realized he had an uphill battle to climb, but it wasn't coming across as strong as it could have. So could I have voted for Ken? Yes. If he had blown my mind away with that answer, you know, maybe I would have voted for Ken. But I was really basing my vote on who played the best strategic game. And at that point, Adam had clearly played the best strategic game out of the three of them. He managed to sit in a final three with two people that, you know, he knew that he had a great chance in beating. If he had been sitting there next to Jay or David, he wouldn't have won. But he managed to get himself in that position and play the game kind of, you know, in the middle and find that. And I call it that sweet spot that so many people aren't able to find in Survivor. And Adam did that. So I had to give him the, you know, the props that he deserved for doing that. And also, I was impressed. I mean, he did a great job. And so that's really what it boiled down to me, was even though I have a great relationship with Ken, I like him as a person. He's a wonderful individual. This is a game where you have to strategize and you have to outplay, outwit, outlast. And, you know, he was missing components of that.
We've heard from Adam that he left that tribal council, that final tribal council, feeling like he had won. And I think a lot of the jurors felt the same way. Do you think Ken realized what his position was going to be? Because after that final vote was read and after the finale, he seemed very down, at least in, you know, some of the interviews he did and things like that. So do you think it was a surprise to him the way it all ended up?
I think he was surprised that he didn't get any votes. And I think that he was hoping for second. And I say that because he actually voiced that to an individual prior to that person coming to Ponderosa, that he was hoping for second. And I think for all of us, that was a little shocking as well, because all of us sitting at the table were hoping to win. You know, we were playing the game because we wanted to win. And when you've kind of resigned yourself to second, I think that that speaks volumes of what you think about your own gameplay. And so I think in his mind, he was expecting at least a couple of votes so he would at least get second. So I think, too, even when we got to Ponderosa after that final tribal, he seemed very down and very kind of just almost broken when we were all done with that tribal council. And I think it was because you have this realization that you've gone 39 days and you are proud of the game that you've played, and he should be, but you're also realizing that somewhere you might have screwed up along the way because you don't think that you pulled it out in the end, which everybody wants to believe that if they sit in the final three, they could win. And that's a hard thing to do. And I think that he was just processing a lot and realizing it. And then once at the live finale, when he didn't get any votes, I think that was really hard for him.
I want to bring in some of the questions from the listeners of the podcast, Jess. And let me start with Marianne Curtin, who wants to know about how did you get the double pink eye? Could you, you know, we didn't touch about that in the hurricane, or sorry, in the typhoon, but exactly when did you realize there was a problem?
Right. When we got on the boats, when they were bringing us out from the storm, that's when I got hit in the eye, and I couldn't see out of my right eye when we got on the boat. So I knew, I'm like, something was in my eye. My eye was messed up. I did have contacts in, so I was hoping that my contact had just gotten a little messed up and I'd be okay. But I definitely had gotten hit in the eye with a piece of sand. But it wasn't until the next night when we were back at camp and I was laying in the shelter, that I started to feel something going on with my eye. Like it's going to sound really gross, but like I could feel like the goop like building up in my eye, and it was feeling puffy and it was feeling sore. So I knew something's going on here. And I said something to production just to give him a heads up. Like, I think something's wrong with my eye. And then by the next morning, when they finally like realized, it was far gone at that point. It was really bad at that point. I had a very swollen right eye, and there was a lot of, you know, nastiness associated with it. And then it quickly started to spread into my left eye. So yeah, it was quick. It came on quick. And once it was there, it was very scary for me, because I thought that they might medevac me, because they didn't know if I was contagious. They didn't know how they were going to handle it. I was kind of quarantined from the entire tribe, where I couldn't share my water bottle. I couldn't share a bowl. I couldn't share food. Every time anyone needed to interact with me, like medical, or someone just taking my water bottle, they were wearing rubber gloves. So it was very apparent that there were some issues. And in my mind, I thought, here we are in a game where you're voting people out. And why wouldn't a tribe who has a potentially infectious person on their tribe want to vote her out?
You know? Right.
like, why not just do that? It's a relatively easy, straightforward vote. So yeah, that was hard. So I was really excited, obviously, when Dr. Joe said I could continue in the game, but there was a really good chance that I could have not been allowed to continue in the game, because that's who ultimately made the decision. And it was right before our first challenge. I had to go see Dr. Joe, and he decided I could stay in the game.
Okay. Steve Chung wants to know, were you able to preserve your Ponderosa abs as you planned to? You look terrific on the jury.
Well, thank you so much. I have tried my hardest, but
it's impossible.
Being at home, it is impossible, because I have access to food that you don't have access to. Mm-hmm. I obviously have a job that requires me to work a lot of hours every single day, so I can't work out like I was on Ponderosa. And I'm really tired by the time, you know, the end of the day rolls around. I just want to sit on the couch with my dogs and my kids. So it's, yeah, I mean, I've done okay. I haven't done as great as I would like, but I think I've done pretty well. I can't complain. I can't complain at all. I'm happy that I've managed to keep most of the weight off, but there's a lot of salt and vinegar chips around here. So, you know, that's a bit of an issue for Jessica.
I saw in the Ponderosa, you were like working out at Ponderosa, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was doing that and I was preparing for a homicide trial at the same time. So that's what I was doing at Ponderosa.
I mean, that's incredible motivation to be like the day after being out of the game and then working out.
Yeah, well, because what else are you going to do? I mean, I could sit there and kick myself over and over again and try to figure, you know, things I should have done differently and what I should have, could have, yourself to death, really. But I couldn't sleep at all the first night. I mean, I couldn't sleep at all because you can't turn off your brain. So when you're there and you have nothing else to do besides, you know, work out or eat, I picked working out. So that's what I decided to do, because they do feed you very well when you are at Ponderosa, and there's lots of snacks and peanut butter and cookies and deliciousness. And there were some salt and vinegar chips as well. So yeah, it was a choice I had to make.
Felipe has an interesting question. Were you allowed to tell the other jurors about the legacy advantage before Ken played it? And if you did, what were their reactions?
I did actually tell them at Ponderosa about it. And they were all quite shocked that I had had it, for one, and they didn't know. And they were also surprised that I had given it to Ken, but they weren't surprised at the same time because they knew the relationship that Ken and I had. And everyone was very anxious and interested to find out what it was. And so when day 36 rolled around, we were all curious, you know, what is this going to be when we get to tribal council? Like, we're going to learn finally what this legacy is. And even though in that moment when I saw what it was and I said I hated the game, I don't hate the game. I don't hate the game at all. I hated the fact that I wasn't the one who was getting to play that legacy on day 36 and have immunity, because what a phenomenal thing to have on day 36. So yeah, that, but yes, we did discuss it and we were all trying to kind of guess, but none of us had guessed that it would be immunity.
Ian Rice wants to know, is there anything about being an attorney that gave you an advantage in the game?
It does and it doesn't. It gives you an advantage, I think, because you have the ability to, I think, multitask and think quick on your feet, because that's what you have to do every day as a trial attorney. But at the same time, that's why I didn't tell anyone I was an attorney, because I was fearful of preconceived notions that people might have with attorneys and what attorneys' capabilities are, or their, you know, ability to play the game. And so I kept that to myself. So it was a hindrance as well as a help in the game. And that's why I didn't share it. But I do think that, you know, you have to have the ability in this game to work through all of the various scenarios and different outcomes. And as a lawyer, that's what you really have to do. When you're looking at a case, you really have to think through every option and every possibility. And you have to try to guess what a defense is going to be, and guess what someone might, you know, if someone testifies to something that you're not expecting, how are you going to fix that? And how are you going to move forward? And how are you still going to make it work for you? So it does help you, because it just prepares you to think differently about, you know, a situation.
Now, being an attorney, did you have to modify your language? Because I work with a lot of attorneys, and I work for an attorney, actually. And I know the way she speaks. And so Brett, the alleged funeral director, at one time was saying, he was talking about people were culpable. They were culpable. And I'm like, no funeral director on the face of this earth uses the word culpable. The people who do that are attorneys and policemen.
Right. Oh, and I totally agree with you. And that was something I was very cognizant of and aware of as I move forward. Just how do you talk to people? Because, yeah, I mean, when I ask people questions when they're on the stand, I might use words like things that are not in everyday language, but you feel like you have to, because that's the way that you ask a question. You know, what direction of travel did the vehicle go? You know, I mean, like, those are the kind of things that you might say instead of where did you see the car? You know, like where was, you know, it's like, so yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that I had to be aware of, because you don't necessarily want to call attention to yourself. And it was hard because I think it did affect me in the game because it quieted me to a certain extent because I didn't want to say the wrong thing. I didn't want to reveal too much about who I was. I didn't want to give anything away. So yeah, I do think that I had to make some serious adjustments concerning how I was going to be seen and things that I would say.
Okay, Jess. And then finally, Jason Auric wants to know, is there any chance you're joining us for Live Know-It-Alls this spring?
I don't know. Am I?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not your travel agent. Your friends were at the last one.
I know. I would definitely love to be there. It's going to depend greatly on my work schedule, my family life, obviously, and all of those great things that, you know, come with being a wife and a mother and someone with a full-time job. So hopefully I will. I would definitely love to.
Okay. You may just send your friends down again as surrogates.
I could certainly do that. But I would like to be there.
Jess, thank you so much again for taking some time to talk with us and go through this game one more time. I think, did you put the rock on eBay? Was that a real thing or that was just a joke that you were going to sell it?
That was totally a spoof. I dropped the rock on the ground because I was really upset at that moment. I didn't care to have the rock.
Oh, yeah, you don't even have the real one.
I don't even have the real rock. I'm upset that I don't. But at that moment, the rock was the last thing I wanted. So, yeah, that was dropped at my feet. And that's where it stayed. I don't know if it ever left Fiji, but I did decide I needed to lighten the mood when that happened, because obviously that was a huge moment for the show. I know that you talked to Adam about it. You know, it could be seen as a hero move. It obviously goes down in history as, you know, only the third person ever to be rocked out of Survivor. And did I want to be part of that history? Well, I didn't want to be that one, but I am that one. And because I am that one, I decided, you know, to make it a little bit more light and fun. Let's turn it into this, you know, joke and see if people can laugh with me instead of being, you know, upset with me. And that's exactly what happened. People loved it. They thought it was great. Jeff Probst even retweeted it, which was amazing. I thought that was incredible to see that. You know, you have to really, you can't take yourself too serious in this game. I mean, this is a game for $1 million and only one person can win. And you really have to own what you did, and you have to, you know, not kick yourself and rethink everything that you did. And so I wanted to just say, yeah, I mean, this was how I went out in the game, but I can still have a sense of humor about it.
If you want to track down Jessica on social media, at JessicaLewis89, verified on Twitter. Except no imposters.
I am verified. That's right. I'm verified. So.
Yes.
And
yes.
Can I say one more thing before I go? I know you're trying to get rid of me, and I understand. But
no, we can't get rid of you unless we get a bag of rocks out. That's the only way we can get rid of you.
I do want to say there was one thing that you had discussed with David in the Why Adam Won the Game. And one of the things that David, you referenced was it being, you know, a trigger for you when people said Adam won because of his situation with his mother. And I just feel the need to put this out there that really the only person who knew of his circumstances was Jay. And we didn't know of his circumstances until that final tribal council. And I think that there's been a representation that, you know, sympathy played a factor. And although all of us, I do believe, feel so much pain for Adam and what he went through and how he utilized the pain that he was feeling and his circumstances at home to push himself, that our ultimate determination and decision came down to how well he played that game. And that's really what our vote, I think, was all about. I mean, that affected us all greatly and we all felt for Adam, but truly Adam fully deserving of the $1 million. And I do wish he and his family the best moving forward, considering everything they've gone through.
Absolutely.
So thank you.
How about that, David?
Yeah, well, and that was something that was very clear in those Jury Speaks videos. I think I said it at the time. I have never seen such a unanimous front in those Jury Speaks videos. I definitely say it made writing up and talking about why Adam won a little bit easier.
Mm, yes, this is what he wants. This is what he wants.
David, you're right. David,
you're right. Okay, you happy now?
Oh, I'm happy.
Okay. All right.
That's fantastic.
All right. Well, Jess, I know you got to get to another Troy Sivan concert, so wrap things up.
I think I need to go eat dinner with my family now, so I think that's what we're going to be doing.
Okay. All right. Enjoy. David, of course, thanks again. You could follow at David Bloomberg on Twitter. David, what have you been busy with in the offseason? Catching up on Hunted?
Yeah, I watched Hunted, catching up on various other shows that I had fallen behind on, those scripted shows. I managed to catch up on, but now the regular season for many of them is starting again, and so I'm going to fall behind again.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you both so much, and all the best, okay?
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, everybody, there you have it. Jessica Lewis and David Bloomberg here on the podcast to talk through everything from millennials versus Gen X. Boy, we've got a very fun week of podcasts coming up this week. Of course, The Celebrity Apprentice is going to get back into action on Monday night. Only 3 episodes left of the Arnold Schwarzenegger new Celebrity Apprentice. Of course, News AF has been firing on all cylinders all through this Survivor offseason. We've been talking Hunted. People have really seemed to enjoy the podcast we're doing about Hunted. I thought that the show was kind of corny after the first episode, but I'll admit it, I thought that the second episode was pretty good of Hunted. So looking forward to getting back into that on Wednesday night. And then later this week, I've got another off-season podcast coming up for you where Mike Bloom and I are going to do a podcast all about some of the most famous and infamous Survivor last words, the things that people say as the votes are being shown to the audience over the credits at the end of the episode. That should be a lot of fun to get back together with Mike Bloom. So hoping you guys check it all out. You can subscribe to the podcast. Go to robsthewebsite.com/iTunes. Looking forward to hearing what you guys had to say about everything we discussed with Jessica on our website, robisawebsite.com, and looking forward as we get one day closer and closer to the kickoff of the Survivor 34 preseason. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.